Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. I'm your producer emeritus, and glad to have you listening. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls. At a political level, the science of global warming is still hotly disputed, so to speak. Among climate scientists, there is a clear and growing consensus that we have already released enough heat-trapping emissions to crank up the global greenhouse several degrees Fahrenheit in the coming century. But some senators rely on authorities like science fiction writer Michael Crichton to argue that global warming is an environmentalist hoax. Whether you choose to believe Michael Crichton or the climate scientists is, of course, up to you. Any scientific theory, including the theory of human-induced climate change, can never really be proven if it is true. It can only be disproven if it is false. And so we have the ongoing political debate over the theory of global warming in the face of evidence that the planet is indeed rapidly getting warmer. During this hour, Focus 580, we'll talk about some of that evidence, about the scientific work on climate change, and about the political climate in which the debate over global warming and our responsibility for it is being played out. Our guest is Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer for The New Yorker, whose recent three-part series for that magazine examines all these issues. The series, entitled The Climate of Man, appeared in the April 25th, May 2nd, and May 9th editions of The New Yorker. Elizabeth Colbert's work on the series took her to Alaska, Greenland, the Netherlands, and many other places where researchers are documenting effects predicted by climate models. She also spoke with political leaders about the global response to global warming, including members of the Bush administration, who have taken a very different view from both the climate scientists and the leadership of most other nations. We'll talk about all these things with Elizabeth Colbert during this hour. As we do that, we invite you into the conversation. Your questions and comments are welcome on this topic. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and call us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Outside of Champaign-Urbana, we have a toll-free line anywhere in the Midwest here, and if you're listening online anywhere in the U.S., 800-222-9455. A little bit more about our guest, Elizabeth Colbert. She has been a staff writer of The New Yorker since January 1999. She previously worked for The New York Times, in fact, for many years. She served as The New York Times Albany Bureau Chief. And she also covered the 1992 and 1996 national elections and wrote profiles of many prominent politicians. And since January 1997, she wrote the Metro Matters column for the New York Times. And she joined the New Yorker in January 1999. And she joins us this morning by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate your time. To begin, let's start with the science. Is it correct to say that the greenhouse effect of atmospheric gases is pretty much uncontested in the scientific community?
Well, there's something called the natural greenhouse effect, which is absolutely uncontested. It was basically discovered, I guess if that's the right word, in the 1850s by a British scientist. And what it says is that there are certain gases in the atmosphere, most significantly water vapor and carbon dioxide, that basically trap heat in the atmosphere, and we can go into exactly how. They trap infrared radiation, and they let visible radiation, light, through, and they trap heat as it's leaving the Earth. And that keeps the planet habitable. Without those gases in the atmosphere, the temperature, the average temperature of the Earth would be about 0 degrees.
So it's basically a matter of energy coming in being trapped in the atmosphere.
Exactly.
A balance effect, essentially.
Well, in order for the Earth's climate to be in balance, the Earth has to emit as much energy as it is taking in from the sun, and it emits energy in the form of thermal radiation, infrared radiation, which, so if you were looking at the Earth with, you know, infrared goggles, you would see that it was always emitting energy. And those two energy streams, the energy we absorb and the energy we give out, have to be in balance, and that is the basic, you know, principle behind global warming. And the more heat-trapping gases you put into the atmosphere, basically the warmer the Earth has to get in order to make those two energy streams balance out.
Okay. So the question for us is really the effect of human-caused increases in global greenhouse gases in terms of the problem that it creates for us.
Well, we have lived, the Earth has had a certain level of greenhouse gases since human history, the dawn of what we would call, you know, human history, going back about 10,000 years. And that can be shown through ice cores, that if you go down into ice cores, there are tiny, tiny bubbles that are in the ice, and they trap the air that was in circulation at the time. And we have that record going back quite far, and from the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets. And we have a very good idea what the atmosphere has looked at for the entire time that human beings have been around. And we are now have levels of greenhouse gases that are significantly higher than they have been at any other time since modern humans have walked the Earth.
And we think that's because of our use of fossil fuels and other kinds of industrial activities, agricultural activity, in fact. That
I think would be too weak a word.
Okay.
We know that. I mean, that's uncontested.
Okay. How much change are we inducing in the atmosphere, the concentration of these elements?
Well, CO2 concentrations have gone up roughly by a third or so since we... since the Industrial Revolution in the 18th century, and methane concentrations. Methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. It's what basically comes out of rice paddies and garbage dumps. That has doubled. And then there are other greenhouse gases that we've created. Basically, they're human-made chlorofluorocarbons, which are responsible for depleting the ozone layer. People might have heard of them in that context. They are also very powerful greenhouse gases. So there are several greenhouse gases, about half a dozen, and all of them have risen quite dramatically.
And this is essentially this acceleration of the emission of greenhouse gases. It dates from the industrial period, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, essentially?
Yes. I mean, as I said, that can also be seen pretty clearly from the ice core record, quite clearly.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
How much will this accelerate, given the growth of our economies around the world that depend on, various things that, emit these kinds of gases?
Right. Well, that's sort of the $64,000 question, or I guess a $64,000 question, and that depends on... whether we decide to take into account the problems that this is going to create, or whether we just continue sort of on our merry way. And if we just continue on our merry way, there are good reasons to believe that CO2, which is the most gas we are adding in the greatest quantities, and so that's why it's usually talked about the most, that it will double by the middle of this century. And the implications of that are quite dramatic. The Earth takes a while to adjust to anything that we put into the atmosphere because of the capacity of the oceans to absorb heat and things like that. But so when they run climate models, they run them out for many decades to see what the reaction of the climate will be once things are sort of back in an equilibrium. And if the equilibrium temperature increase associated with a doubling of CO2 in the atmosphere, which we would reach by the middle of this century, is anywhere from around 4 to 8 or 9 degrees Fahrenheit, and that may not sound like that much to people, but it should be kept in mind that the difference between the period we're in now and the last ice age was only a 10 degree difference.
I want to get to the politics of this, of course, but I want to underscore the scientific work as you write about in this series. Thus far we talked about sort of the theoretical underpinnings of the scientists
right.
working on this stuff. And I think in the introduction put it like it's non-controversial for most climate scientists. Is that in fact the case? Did I overstate that? I mean, is there in fact a disagreement among the scientists working on this if in fact there is a problem?
I'd say there's virtually no disagreement. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, perhaps a little too technically, there's no disagreement that the greenhouse effect exists. And all that global warming says is if you increase that amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, you increase the Earth's temperature. And that is also uncontroversial.
Mm-hmm.
There will be some disagreement about exactly how much based on, running these climate models, and there's a lot of feedbacks in the climate system. So all of that is very, very complicated. But on the basic fact, even people who call themselves so-called global warming skeptics really cannot and do not deny that all things being equal, you increase the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, you increase the Earth's temperature. Mm-hmm.
There are various models that there are different models that have different assumptions that you know, look at and crunch the numbers, all the factors that are, you know, pouring into the atmosphere and maybe countervailing effects and so forth and feedback loops. And they're very, you know, maybe complicated algorithms and so forth. You write about, you know, some of the code that goes into these models.
Right.
But essentially, they are making predictions based on what we know about what's happening on the Earth.
Yes, they're making predictions on the basis of two things. They're making predictions on the basis of basic principles of physics, like,
yeah,
you know, conservation of energy, conservation of momentum, things like that. And they're making predictions on the basis of processes that can be observed in nature. So they go out and they look at, you know, how does water evaporate off a forest, and they will write an algorithm that tries to mimic that numerically. Now, obviously, you know, you can never get at the complexity of the world.
Right. But there are certain, you know, sort of core observations that you can, or core predictions you can make and then go and test in observing what is happening.
Yes, and you know, those predictions, you know, you might say tragically, have been quite well borne out. Now, some people would say, well, they haven't been perfectly borne out. The models have not, you know, succeeded in perfectly predicting what we've actually seen. And that's true. But they have, the directionality of the models was always that the world was going to get warmer, that it was going to get warmer most significantly in the northern latitudes. And all of those things have turned out to be true.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about some of what you observed in the various places you traveled to prepare this series. And first, I wanted to ask you to talk about Alaska, where you write about changes in the permafrost, for example.
Right. Well, Alaska is warming up just about as fast as any place on Earth. There are parts of Alaska where winter temperatures, once again, another effect of global warming that was predicted, is that winter temperatures would rise more than summer temperatures, where winter temperatures have risen by about 7 degrees, and that's very, very dramatic. And people in Alaska are quite conscious of this. They now have, you know, hot summers. People say, well, you know, we need air conditioning. They've had very, very bad forest fires, which are also a predicted effect of global warming as the soil dries out. So they are quite aware that something is going on to the climate up there. And I went out with a guy who is measuring the temperature of the permafrost. A lot of Alaska is basically built on frozen ground. And a lot of it is very, very, very close to the thawing part. And, in fact, in places where people live and have sort of disturbed the top of the ground, a lot of it is thawing, and people's houses are falling apart, and the roads develop these, you know, to call them a pothole is really not to do them justice. They sort of cave in and have these huge holes in them. When the permafrost underneath the roadbed gives way.
And this, didn't really know much about permafrost. I found that, that kind of interesting, that this is essentially ground that's frozen, you know, a mile deep or something, and has been for thousands of years or perhaps longer.
Right. I mean, the permafrost in Alaska, it's estimated that most of it has been around for at least one glacial cycle, and glacial cycles take 100,000 years. We are now in an interglacial cycle. The last glaciers receded about 10,000 years ago. And before that, we were in an ice age, and that lasted about 100,000 years. So that permafrost has been around for more than 110,000 years.
And this is really surprising, the people who are studying this, that it is indeed, you know, for the first time in all this period, essentially a lot of it is showing signs of melting.
Yes, and it's a very good, one of the reasons that permafrost is studied is because it can be hard to find trends in air temperature because they bounce around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But and that confuses people on the ground. They'll say, well, we had a, you know, cold winter. How can we have global warming? But if you look at the permafrost temperature, it sort of is a filter, and it filters out short-term changes and only really records long-term changes. And the long-term trend is warm, warm, warm.
That's very interesting. Another issue that you write about is the Arctic sea ice and how rapidly it is being affected. Can you talk about that?
Sure. The Arctic sea ice is a pretty is another very dramatic indicator of and symptom of global warming, and it has shrunken very dramatically by a size area about the size of I think it's like Texas and Arizona combined is how people sometimes say it. And the import of that, in addition to just shrinking sea ice and what that might tell us about rising temperatures, is that ice is a very, very good reflector. It reflects sunlight, and water is a very bad reflector. It absorbs sunlight. And what you set up is a feedback, and feedbacks are very important in the climate system because they take little changes in temperature and they magnify them. And it turns out, it seems, that there are many positive feedbacks in the system, so that even relatively small changes can turn out to be quite big. And sea ice is one of those positive feedbacks. As you melt the ice, the world absorbs more sunlight. As you absorb more sunlight, you melt more ice.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce our guest this morning during this hour of Focus 580. We're talking with Elizabeth Colbert. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker, and her three-part series recently was published in The New Yorker entitled The Climate of Man, looking at the science, a lot of the science, and certainly some of the politics as well, of climate change. And that's what we're talking about this morning. If you'd like to join us, your phone calls are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. We have a couple callers getting lined up, but I just, as a quick follow-up to your last point about the feedback loops, in speaking of the sea ice turning into water and it no longer reflects energy but actually absorbs it, and so it increases the warming effect. What do we know about what has happened toward the end of previous periods of glaciation when there was rapid climate change? How fast did things change?
Well, some of those changes did happen pretty fast. In fact, there's a certain question of how we got out of those ice ages so fast. But some of these feedbacks, probably played a role, and there were periods when sea level was rising at, I think, at the rate of, a foot a decade. And that is very, very dramatic, as you can imagine. So 3 feet in 30 years, that would inundate, many, many parts of the world right now. Now, there was a tremendous amount of ice to melt at that point. We are at a period of sort of minimal ice right now, but there's still enough ice to melt that if you started melting it, you could, and managed to melt it all, you could raise global sea levels by tens, dozens of feet.
The interesting thing about that that I think you make clear in the article is this is not something that is going to show up right away. And by the time it actually happens, the cause of it happened a long time ago.
Yes, and I can't sort of, stress any point that's more important than that. And I think it's been very, very hard for scientists to convey that to the general public, and it's one of the reasons that this debate in scientists' mind is so urgent, and in the lay public's mind is like, well, we'll deal with it when we get around to it, when we can really feel it. And the point that is so important to keep in mind is you cannot deal with it when you feel it. You have to deal with it beforehand, because when you feel it, when you see it, when sea levels start rising dramatically, it's way too late. And the reason for that is, as I said before, there's a delay in the system. It takes a long time for these changes to work their way through the system, and so things are always sort of farther ahead than you think. And the other problem that you have is that carbon dioxide in particular is a gas that lasts a long time. It lasts about 100 years. So once it's in the air, it's there for 100 years, and you simply cannot get rid of it at that point.
We have a couple callers. Let's include them in our conversation. We'll go first to a listener in Urbana, line number one. Good morning.
Good morning. I have no trouble accepting your guest's conclusions. They've been evolving steadily over some decades now by perfectly reputable scientists, I presume expressing themselves in peer-reviewed journals and academic papers. But how can these scientists compete with what David Brock calls the Republican noise machine, and other people like this John Stossel, whose motives defy explanation, who are out to either deny or discredit the scientists?
Well, I mean, I think that's a very good question that you ask. And, you know, I guess that's the job of people like me. But it isn't easy. And, you know, you can open a lot of publications and find a lot of, you know, ad campaigns by, you know, companies that have a sort of vested interest in the energy world remaining as it is right now. And so there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of money and effort, as the caller points out, being put into, if not discrediting the science, then sort of putting up a fog. And I think that that fog is very, very, very dangerous because, as I mentioned before, we don't have a lot of time. I mean, the scientific community would say we are already in a potentially very dangerous zone, and we really need to start acting right away.
Well, our wonderful administration here has jumped up and down about the Congress not passing their energy plan, but I doubt very much if dealing with global warming is a major part of their plan, unless you can tell me different.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. It's absolutely the reverse. I mean, the energy plan is about, you know, finding new sources of fossil fuel in general and speeding up the extraction of fossil fuels. And fossil fuels are, you know, far and away the major source of greenhouse gases in this country and really throughout the world. There's also changes in land use, like cutting down forests has the effect of contributing greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. But burning fossil fuels is really the key to global warming. And so, yes, the energy bill goes in, you know, basically exactly the wrong direction.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Just a quick follow-up, and we'll get to some more callers. I found it interesting, and I think I'd remembered this, that during the presidential campaign in 2000, George W. Bush made the statement that he took global warming very seriously and that he you know, essentially was on the side of people who wanted to really address, you know, what we're doing to the atmosphere and so forth. And within a year of taking office, that position had changed dramatically.
Yes, I mean, that is true, and that was a real, you know, for anyone who cared about the issue and who voted for George Bush, that was a real bait and switch. I mean, as people might recall, you know, Al Gore was pretty out front on global warming, although many people, you know, would argue that the Clinton administration didn't do enough on this issue either. But Al Gore wrote the book Earth in the Balance back in 1992, which, you know, talked very seriously about this issue. And then when George Bush ran against him, he said, yes, I too take global warming very seriously. And then, as you point out, he said that he was going to, he didn't believe in the Kyoto Protocol, which is a UN treaty on global warming. He was going to do something domestically. And it is now, you know, 2005, and that has never happened. In fact, he renounced that idea very soon after taking office. It was one of the very first things that he did. And the administration has still maintains that it takes global warming very seriously. That's a quote. But I'd say one would be hard-pressed to find evidence of that.
We're at our midpoint here with Elizabeth Colbert. She's staff writer for The New Yorker. Her three-part series, The Climate of Man, recently appeared in that magazine on the science and some politics as well of climate change, and that's what we're talking about. We have a couple callers waiting and would welcome others, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Indiana, line number 4. Good morning.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could possibly tease out the subtleties, if there are any, with the Bush administration's group of scientists, if there is a group of scientists that believe that all this is hurly-burly and we ought to get on with the job of pumping oil. versus, you know, do we have any large associations or, you know, the group of 20 scientists to sign something? I wonder if you could get into that to give some sort of image of just where the war is, actually. And I mean, I'm one that goes with some years ago. These things were starting out in certain journals I read. And I know that the evidence is accumulating extremely fast on the global warming side. So I just sort of wonder, it almost makes me think it's just purely political, but you'd think that some Republicans are not all dumb, that there must be something about what this other guy is saying that gives them at least a reason to, you know, go along with the boss, so to speak.
Well, I have a couple of things to say about that.
Okay. Thanks
a
lot.
It's a very good, you know, point that you raise. And the notion, you know, not all Republicans are dumb, and I would certainly agree with that, and I should mention that John McCain is a very, very outspoken leader in the fight to impose greenhouse gas limits in this country and to do something about global warming. He's quite eloquent on the subject. So it is not an issue that, you know, completely breaks down Republicans and Democrats.
Well, indeed, and there are Democrats who are also not, you know, of the view that we ought to be taking drastic measures that would hurt our economy.
Absolutely. So, you know, that's true. And in terms of the administration and whom they listen to, I think there's perhaps a good illustration from this story. The Bush administration asked the National Academy of Sciences to do a sort of state-of-the-art look at global warming, which many people interpreted as basically just a time-buying strategy, because really this had been done a million times before and always showed the same thing. But needless to say, the National Academy of Sciences did do this. They produced this report about 4 years ago, and it came to two conclusions. One of them was global warming is real, it's happening, right now, it can be observed. The second was there are still many questions that we need to answer about what exactly the impact will be. Now, you would think that the key point is global warming is real, it's happening right now, and it's potentially quite dangerous. They also pointed that out. But the administration seized on there are many questions that need to be answered, and they put in place a 10-year, you know, research program. Now, there's a lot of good things about that, and there's a lot of important things that still need to be researched. But I really think that you're not going to change the basic conclusion that, you know, global warming is real, it's happening, and the only way to do anything about it is to curb your emissions of greenhouse gases. You just can't, it's really hard to get around those facts.
We have another call to talk with. Let's include them. This is a listener in Charleston on line number 2. Good morning.
Yes, I'm trying not to be redundant on this subject, but the parallels between our present paradigm, which is bourgeois capitalism, and the will to change that is going to be non-existent until there is some sort of revolutionary activity. We can talk things to death and have done so from the 18th century, as your guest has indicated. There is no push to change how we live, how we are socially organized, how we produce the goods and services that we need to maintain what we now have as urban, mainly urban living. And does your guest have any opinions about that? And when and what can we expect? My opinion is that we're not going to stop using fossil fuels. The last tree is burned, the last lump of coal, and the last drop of oil have been wiped out. By then, it's too late. I'll hang up and take your answer.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Well, that's a, you know, very depressing but not unrealistic view. How's that? I mean, I think, you know, the last lump of coal, people have done calculations. If we, you know, really decided to run through all our fossil fuels without any regard to what we were doing to the atmosphere, what could we do to CO2 levels? And they're just, you know, sort of astronomical, just completely off the charts. And so if we were to do that, we could, you know, just completely change the atmosphere and completely alter the climate of the world to state it probably hasn't been in you know, tens and tens of millions of years. However, I believe that we will not be able to do that because long before then we will start to see very, very serious consequences. And so, you know, on some level there's a break on things, whether we will be able to take action prior to that, just on the basis of foreknowledge, on the basis of what we've been warned about, and so we can avoid some of the most disastrous consequences, I can't answer that. I have to agree that the signs out of Washington are not good. How's that?
Yeah. Well, you know, that leads into an area I wanted to ask you about. In your report, you speak with, you know, several people about measures we might take to actually reduce or even stabilize greenhouse emissions,
right,
and what that would require. And in particular, I wanted to ask you to talk about Robert Sokolow's stabilization wedges, these various strategies for even stabilizing greenhouse gases.
Right. Well, some scientists at Princeton, that is what you're referring to, got together and said, let's say we wanted to keep CO2 levels from doubling. That's sometimes considered the benchmark of sort of between, you know, very serious effects of global warming and disastrous effects. Although I should point out that that's not clear. That would be a matter of scientific debate. When does, you know, what's the disaster level?
Mm-hmm.
But let's take that as a benchmark. And in part, one of the reasons they took it as a benchmark, to be honest, was because they thought it was potentially achievable. Whereas certain things that are lower enter the realm of really, could we even do that even if we tried at this point?
Mm-hmm.
So they took that as a benchmark, and they said, what do you need to do? And they decided the first thing you need to do is not let CO2 emissions grow over the next 50 years. And how could you do that? Well, they came up with a variety of different ways, and these include things like instead of building coal plants, we should build nuclear power. We could. I shouldn't say we should. They didn't take a position on this. They just said, here are the options.
Yeah.
We could
right.
put up windmills. We could put up solar arrays. We could build nuclear power plants. All those things are emissions-free. Instead of buying cars that, you know, get 20 miles to the gallon, we could buy cars that get 40 miles to the gallon or 60 miles to the gallon. Instead of driving 10,000 miles a year, as we all do, we could drive 5,000 miles a year. These are all steps that we could take that would essentially keep emissions from growing. They would simply stay the same over the next 50 years. That would still mean that 50 years from now we'd have to take very dramatic action to reduce emissions further, but they thought that that goal of stabilizing them would sort of buy us time and allow us to maybe come up with new technologies that would allow us to reduce our use of fossil fuels still further.
Mm-hmm. And some of those, these different wedges that Sokolov describes, you know, the wedge number 11, photovoltaic technology, solar power, it would have to essentially be on a massive scale. Is that?
Yeah, and I think that the exercise was very sobering to a lot of people, and people who would say, well, we can do this. All we need to do is use renewable sources of energy. But you look at the numbers, and they're pretty daunting. Solar power is only produced when the sun is shining, so you need a lot of solar panels to produce the kind of electricity you get from a coal plant that runs, you know, 24 hours a day. And it turned out that to get one wedge, you know, which I won't go into the exact details of what that is, but it was a step. You needed at least seven of these steps, and this was globally,
yeah,
not just in the U.S. You needed solar arrays covering an area basically the size of Connecticut.
There are other ideas we could talk about with that, and we may follow up, but I wanted to, actually, one of the questions I wanted you to speak to is, not only are we not doing these wedges at the current time, and there are ideas that are on the table that perhaps should be pursued, but in fact, if you look at the development of additional sorts of energy-producing activities, especially in the developing world, the opposite is the case, that we're actually, you know, sort of increasing the future output by building more plants, especially like in China, that is just on the verge of building a lot of coal-fired power plants and so forth.
Yes, well, that's the really, a really scary thing. Although I should point out that, you know, China is often used, and you'll often hear, or I've often heard people say, well, you know, it doesn't matter what we do, the Chinese are just going to, you know, keep spewing out CO2, and what difference does it make, so why should we bother? And I should point out that we are by far the biggest emitter in the world of CO2, and we are going to continue to outpace China for many, many years to come, no matter what the Chinese do, basically, and they are intent on outpacing us. Now, many people would argue that, you know, it's absolutely clear that we need to curb our emissions and the Chinese need to curb their emissions. And without both of those things, this problem cannot be solved, or ameliorated, I think would be a better word. And I think people who look at this problem and are very concerned about it would say we probably are going to need to assist the Chinese. The Chinese have a much, you know, lower standard of living than we do. They have historically put less CO2 into the atmosphere, so on some level you could say they have less of a debt to the world than we do. And if we want to solve this problem, we are probably going to have to take the initiative and funnel money to them, and the Europeans as well. And I think that is probably what is going to have to happen, that we are going to have to contribute to their shifting to different sources of energy. As opposed to developing the way we did, we're going to have to try to encourage them to develop differently.
We just have about maybe 12 minutes left with our guest, Elizabeth Colbert. She is a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. We're talking about her three-part series, The Climate of Man, which looks at the science and politics of climate change. If you'd like to join our conversation in the time remaining, you should certainly do that. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Your last point leads neatly into the thing I wanted to ask about, the international treaties, for example, the Kyoto Protocol, that seek to address the stabilization or reduction, or at least slow the growth of greenhouse gases. What would, for example, the Kyoto Protocol require of the various parties?
Well, the Kyoto Protocol divided the world into two groups: developed nations, basically, and developing nations. And it required of developed nations, of which we are one, obviously, that they reduce their emissions below 1990 levels. And as time went on and emissions kept growing and growing, this goal became that much more, you know, difficult to meet. But all of the industrialized nations in the world, and developed nations in the world, besides us and Australia, are committed to this goal. It's unclear whether they're going to meet the goal, but they're committed to trying to meet it. We in Australia are the only country that has rejected even the goal. As for developing countries, they had no obligation, but one of the ways that, and I should also point out, Kyoto only lasts till 2012, mm-hmm. and you'll need a new treaty. Mm-hmm. Developed countries could meet some of their obligations by investing in these clean energy technologies for developing countries. So one hope would be that through those investments you could ameliorate some of the problems of developing countries, you know, jacking up their CO2 production.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's been some criticism of it in terms of fairness, that it demands more of, the industrialized nations than it does of the developing countries.
Well, you know, absolutely it demands more of developed nations, and there's no doubt about that. And, you know, it depends on what your notion of fairness is, to be frank. And developing countries would say, well, we didn't create this problem. And historically, if you look at emissions, you know, they're absolutely right. Developed countries created the problem. And now to say, well, now everyone needs to participate in the solution, you can see how from the developing countries' point of view that would not be considered fair. Now you can also see from an American company's point of view, competing against a Chinese company, we have limits, they don't. They can say, well, that's not fair. So it depends on your view of fairness.
But the overall goal is, I guess, what the international community needs to essentially address.
Well, I should say that the model for the Kyoto Protocol, and it's worth keeping in mind because it wasn't something that just, you know, came out of the blue. It was the model for the Kyoto Protocol was the agreement that phased out chlorofluorocarbons, which created the ozone hole, and which everyone agrees was also a potentially, you know, disastrous situation. And what happened was developed countries had to phase them out first, and developing countries had sort of a time lag and are still in the process of phasing them out. And it was considered basic, once again, a matter of fairness. And it has been very successful. We are phasing out chlorofluorocarbons, and we are dealing with the ozone hole. So it was hoped that the same thing could be done with CO2, but it turns out that that has been, you know, much, much more difficult.
We have several callers waiting to talk with us. Let's include our next listener from Terre Haute, line number 4. Good morning.
Hi. Mm-hmm. My name is Denise, and I'm an educator, and I really feel strongly that educators need to focus a lot more on teaching critical thinking skills. Just the fact that Bush is president, despite the overwhelming evidence that he was not the most qualified person for the job, shows that we really have a terrible problem with people not being able to analyze evidence. And the issues surrounding global warming, again, show that we have people that are running our country that are not looking at scientific evidence. Instead, they're looking at Michael Crichton, MD. He's not a researcher. He's not a scientist. And they're looking at him instead as a person speaking on the matter. That was my first point. Critical thinking is definitely lacking in our country. And as if you're an educator, you need to start doing that more. And the second point is about renewable energy. It would be great if we had a government that would currently give us incentives to do more renewable energy. And it really works best, like solar and windmills and a small hydroelectric, really works best at the local level. My husband and I are thinking of maybe putting in some solar panels. We also have an opportunity to, like, maybe do a little hydroelectric thing at our place. I was in Costa Rica last summer, and all of the electricity in this little place in the jungle was generated by a very small hydroelectric generator that was just a tiny little stream of water. So renewable energy at the local level is something we probably should be looking at more. And I just hope that someday soon the people running this country will start looking at evidence, and the people that are electing these people will start looking at evidence and voting for people that are really the best people for the job.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
I don't know if there's any response you want to make on that, or.
Well, I certainly agree with the caller that it's a kind of daunting, I suppose I'll use that word, to think that our elected officials will quote Michael Crichton on the floor of the Senate as an expert on global warming. That gives one pause, certainly.
Well, I want to ask you about something, and I promise I'll get to the callers who are waiting quickly after this. But, you know, doesn't the media also play a significant role in either clarifying or putting the fog, you know, spreading the fog, as you put it? It seems that the notion that the media has to balance the issue with, say, on one side, you know, the vast majority of climate scientists who say this is really serious, and as you point out, they think it's more serious really than anyone. I mean, scientists are reluctant to get, you know, all upset about things, but
right.
In this case, you know, they feel it's justified. They're more concerned about it than just about anyone else. You know, and then the media will report that, but then they'll, because we have this notion of balance, we'll give equal time to Michael Crichton or someone who is an, you know, industry-sponsored spokesperson who says, yes, but there are many questions. You know, and how, you know, I guess I'm asking you as a reporter, how do you deal with that? I mean, you clearly, your piece is very strong in the sense that you, you know, you essentially, it's not this attempt to say, oh, yes, but we can't really decide because there are different views.
Well, I think you know, that's a very good point, and people have written a lot about it and how this balance, this notion of balance, has really obscured the issue. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, and I will refer to a study that I referred to in the piece, which I think was very, very illustrative, and a woman in California, University of California, did a study, and she looked at all of the articles on climate change, or the keyword climate change, in a certain database, which is a leading research database, and she analyzed them. She said, did any of these articles take the position that global warming is not occurring? And what she found was that 75% of the articles took the position that global warming is occurring. 25% of them dealt with questions of past climates or things like that, and so didn't take any positions. And not, and this was more almost 1,000 articles that had appeared over a 10-year period, and not a single one of them took the position that global warming is not occurring. And her point was, you know, you can sit around waiting for a scientific consensus, or you can acknowledge that there is a scientific consensus that is there. And I think that that is a point, and I think that you are going to see that increasingly reflected in stories about global warming, because the scientific consensus is there. There are still a few, you know, sort of outliers. You can find scientists, even, you know, legitimate scientists who will disagree about virtually anything. You can probably find scientists who will say, you know, we still have doubts about evolution. But that is not the scientific consensus.
Okay. We have several callers. We'll try to include as many as we can. Next up, someone on line number one from Stewartson. Good morning.
Hello?
Yes.
I've heard before that you would have to cover the size of Connecticut with solar panels to do any good. Well, you wouldn't actually cover Connecticut, though. Mainly you put them on your roofs and it would all be spread out. I don't see that that's a very useful thing to say because... I would gladly have my whole car be a solar panel or my whole roof and the whole side of my house. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, that's a good point. You know, that's a good point you make, and I think that they were just trying to give people a sense of the scale of the effort needed. It's certainly not an insurmountable problem, and you're right. Connecticut is not that big compared to the surface of the Earth. So, you know, it certainly can be done.
Well, I think an earlier caller alluded to this, too, that, you know, locally generated energy, you know, might be a significant part of a solution in that, you know, it's a different economic model, so it's maybe difficult to implement. But
I think that's true, but I think that the point, I guess to go back to the point that these guys were trying to make, and it's an important one, and it gets to the other point, which is we really need to use less energy. And it's very hard to solve this issue by renewable energy alone. You need a lot of different things, probably, and you probably need to use less energy. And you have to assume that people in the third world are going to be using more energy. It's really not fair to say... you know, we use all this energy, and they should really just stay at what they're at of, you know, 1 hour of electricity a week. So you have to assume they're going to ramp up, and so that means we kind of have to ramp down.
A couple callers waiting. We'll go next to a listener in Kankakee on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Your caller has at least reasonable intelligence and goodwill, and he has perhaps better than average ability to affect public policy. What plan or program for maintaining and improving the health of the ecosystem should he adopt? Thank you.
Okay.
I'm sorry, the question is what would I recommend as a plan for
the
world?
Well, we've been talking a little bit about the various ideas that are on the table, at least on some table somewhere, about these wedges and so forth. So I think, you know, the caller was essentially asking for, you know, maybe more in terms of what are some of the strategies, and, you know, we could certainly talk about that. I mean, one of the things that you write about is there's one scientist that you interview who is, you know, maybe a little bit more, you know, futuristic thinking about this stuff, satellites that collect solar energy in orbit and beam it. I mean, there are a number of these ideas that perhaps could provide part of the solution.
Well, I think that his point, I interviewed a physicist at NYU who was making the point, and I... Unfortunately, you know, sadly, I think that he's probably right, and that gets back to the point that, you know, people in developing countries are not going to say, well, we sort of accept this standard of living because of a climate change problem. So there's a huge, huge potential need for energy out there in the world, or potential desire for energy.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That.
Yeah.
And to meet that, his point was to meet that without, you know, completely destroying the planet by burning fossil fuels, you need a breakthrough kind of emissions-free technology. And I think everyone who looks at this problem would basically agree that over the next century, if we don't find that kind or somehow a shift to that kind of energy, and perhaps there are advances in solar or wind power that could be made, but something, that is providing emissions-free energy, because this is a long, long-term problem. This is, you know, the future. This is forever, basically.
Okay. We have about 2 minutes left. We'll squeeze in one last caller from Belgium, line number 3. Good morning.
Good afternoon. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can end on this thought, sir. The entire discussion we've had here so far has been pretty much homocentric. In other words, global warming is something that people concern about because it's a people problem. But if we look back at through the history of the Earth didn't care whether it was high carbon dioxide levels in the beginning or in the land. And different times throughout the history, there have been high carbon dioxide levels and very high other types greenhouse type gases. So really what we should really think more along in a Earth sense, because if we destroy the Earth, you know, it's just us that's gone. It's not the rest of the Earth. It'll find some way to modify itself, and other creatures will come along and live, or maybe even plants will do much better because they do like a little bit warmer and a lot more carbon dioxide. So
okay.
It's just a problem that we have to concern ourselves with. Mother Nature doesn't really care how we deal with the problem because she's going to take care of it in the long run anyway.
I think that's a very good point. You know, we should be concerned because we are humans. but as for, you know, life on Earth will go on. I completely agree with that. It will look different, but it will go on.
Yeah, well, I mean, from a human perspective, though, that's not comforting to us humans.
I don't think it should be comforting to humans, but it nevertheless is true.
Okay. Well, we're here at the end of our time, and we'll have to wrap it up. Let me just mention again that this three-part series, The Climate of Man, has been printed in The New Yorker. And actually, I just did a Google search last night and found that you can find it online as well easily. And the author, Elizabeth Colbert, has been our guest. The series, The Climate of Man, appeared April 25th, May 2nd, and May 9th in The New Yorker. And if you want to know more on the subject, you should certainly look at the series. And to you, Elizabeth Colbert, thanks so much for spending time with us.
Thanks for having me.
All right.